call to order the March 13th meeting of the Finance and Administration Committee. To the members of the public, I do apologize for the delay of this meeting. Our sincere apologies. Before you is an agenda for today's meeting as presented by staff. Are there any questions about today's agenda? If not, we'll move forward with the agenda as presented. Next step is the approval of the February 27th minutes. Any questions about the minutes?
Move approval, Mr. Chair.
We have a move for approval. Do I hear a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Giancola. Any questions about the minutes? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The minutes pass. Today we have two action items before the committee. First is the approval of the public outreach staff report and the FY 2015 operating budget and a request to purchase buses on behalf of the District of Columbia. But before we get to the budget item, Assistant General Manager Jack Requa will present for our consideration a request from the district to expand circulated bus service by authorizing Metro to purchase buses on their behalf. So I'll turn over the floor to Mr. Requa.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. The District of Columbia and the National Park Service are nearing finalization of an agreement to provide bus service on the National Mall, which is essentially the replacement of the Touromobile service. That service begins in March of 2015, and 13 buses are required to provide that service. The district has asked us to assist them in the procurement of the buses for this service, and we're requesting board authorization to allow us to do that, which would require the increasing of the circulator budget, authorizing use of capital funding, which has been totally provided by the District of Columbia, to increase the capital reimbursement budget by $11 million, and to authorize staff to assist in purchasing the 13 circulator buses for the National Mall service. We'll indicate that this service is not competitive at all with the Metro services, and this is essentially just operating service on the mall. So we ask any questions. I'd be happy to try to address those.
Thank you, Mr. Requa. Are there any questions?
Mr.
Jack, can you tie this into a future procurement so we get maybe some efficiencies?
Actually, the district has an interest in buying new Flyer buses, and we've been able to, there are options available from a Connecticut contract to do that, so we're just kind of the catalyst to make that happen.
Connecticut?
Connecticut.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for Mr. Requa? I'd just like to say that from the federal government's interest, we think this is a very important service that the District of Columbia Circulator is going to provide for the millions of visitors to the National Mall. This will provide a very affordable service for them, and I think this is a great opportunity. And I do thank both Mr. Bellamy from the District Department of Transportation as well as our colleagues at the National Park Service for pulling this together. So are there any other questions? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? No? It passes. And before we begin our discussion about the budget, what I did take a little prerogative and have requested that both the Riders Advisory Council and the Accessibility Advisory Council, as you know, have prepared recommendations to us regarding the budget. And so I'd ask both groups to come before the committee to just present their recommendations. I've given them each 5 minutes to do so. They've taken the time to pull this together, so I thought it was very important for us to hear from them personally. Now, first we have the overview from the Riders Advisory Committee on the FY 2015 fares. We have Ms. Walker, and I'd like to invite her up to address the committee.
I won't take 5 minutes. Members of the Riders Advisory Council attended all six hearings, and as a result, we formed a budget committee that met and formulated some proposals for Metro that were adopted in toto, except for one exception at the March 5th Riders Advisory Council meeting. In formulating its recommendations, we operated on the basis that the proposed increase that Metro was seeking was both necessary and prudent. And these recommendations, and I'm just going to hit the highlights of them that are included in the letter, is what we are recommending. We recommend, for Metro Rail fares, we recommended a 4% increase to peak fares, but no increase to off-peak fares. And our rationale was that we felt that to keep the off-peak fares constant would be to encourage more off-peak usage, especially by those who have been most impacted by the weekend track work. We were commend the MMATA staff for coming up with the idea of the convention pass, and we definitely agree with that as a way to generate extra revenue at a limited marginal cost. We do not recommend a change to the 28-day rail pass, and that's because there is limited uses of that pass as it is, and we think that with additional marketing plus keeping the fare as it is, we will incentivize regular riders to use it more during off-peak hours, especially on the weekend, and especially those with the decreased federal subsidy. For Metro bus fares, we are proposing an increase of to $1.70 rather than, I think, the $1.75. And we did this because we felt that the proposed Smart Trip bus increase was excessive at 9% and disproportionate. And we were trying to propose an increase in line with inflation. The one item that we were not in sync with the budget, our budget committee's recommendation was for dropping the cash surcharge on the Metro bus. There was a lot of discussion among Riders Advisory Council members, and even though we feel this is the right impulse, we feel that it's important to move toward a cashless system, and to drop that surcharge would be sending a message that we're moving in the wrong direction. Parking. We agree with the increases in parking with the exception of the surcharge for Prince George's County. We felt that it was not well explained. Perhaps if we had more information, we could be more enthusiastic. But as it was, we really didn't understand the basis for the special tap on the Prince George's County parking garages. And finally, I guess we want to support the Metro access suggestions and recommendations made by the Accessibility Advisory Committee, specifically those relating to a cap on the maximum fare paid from $7 to $6.50. And we also want to propose that there be some adjustment to the fare calculator. I'm just looking at the presentation, which gives some of the figures, but we understand the need for managing these costs and trying to be reasonable and while meeting the needs of the population, but we feel that the members who spoke so eloquently at each of the public hearings from the community who really needs metric access did a compelling job of convincing us that they do need some relief. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Are there any questions for Ms. Walker and the Riders Advisory Committee? If not, thank you for taking the time to address the Finance Committee. And next up, we'll hear from the Advisory Committee, Mr. Posner.
Good afternoon. I'll be likewise brief since Mark and Carol have made a brilliant presentation and give you all the numbers and the data, but I'd like to remind you that we used to be the Elderly and Disability Committee before we became accessible, and we still like to represent both the elderly and the disability community so they can maintain a decent quality of life. And you're all aware of this. I've heard you talk about it time and time again, including this morning during the bus stops. And in order to do that, what we need is service affordability. You've heard that at all of the hearings. But the other thing you're going to hear today is service sustainability. And we've worked with WMATA staff about something that will be able to give us an affordable system and also be sustainable. And some of the major things that need to be done is to take care of the unanticipated growth that has just happened. In momentum, you predicted a 2-3% growth based upon the previous years and the demographic predictions. But what has happened in the last 2 years, there's been a 4% or larger growth due to social disregard for services that have been provided at the jurisdictional level and the national level. So one of the studies that they're going to present to you is there's been a 25% increase in trips to dialysis centers, a 5 to 10% increase in trips to hospitals on Metro Access. And these are things that need to be addressed. The chairman, Mr. Downs, has sent a letter to the COG. We've been talking to the COG. We have two AFN members on our committee that are working with that. And clearly, something has to be done at a jurisdictional level. I'll make Ms. Hines feel good. I'm an Arlington County representative, and if you look at the jurisdictional contributions to Metro Access, Arlington has the lowest. And if you look at the chart that Mr. Kent presented this morning, they have amongst the highest level of accessible bus stops, and they also run a comparable paratransit system with STAR. And Mary's shaking her head, and I think she'll tell you when she has to talk to her board and explain that the amount that they invest in the local STAR is more than paid back by the reduction in contributions to WMATA. It goes through every year at the budget hearings. And so I think the point that we're trying to make is everyone has to pick up the ball, because we can't forget the elderly and the disability. WMATA has signed on as co-participants in Mayor Gray's Make DC Affordable for the Elderly. Well, transit is one of the most important things. We need to let these people get out of their homes, and I think I should stop now and ask for questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
I have one. Mr. Could you just elaborate on the shedding from the jurisdictions on over to Metro Access? How do you see that, the cities and the counties shedding patrons, and we're picking them up? I mean, do you have any stats to
well,
tell
it's
us
the
about?
It's the social service agencies, and Mr. Kent can give you much more of the data on that, but one of the pilot programs that they're currently carrying out in Montgomery County is exactly that. They're working with Medicaid to supplement transportation of people to dialysis and to hospitals. And so if the individual jurisdictions can come up with that sort of a program working with the federal government and working with some of their money and making some decisions. Again, the cost of what our proposals are, and I didn't even mention our proposals because you all know what they are, but the absolute individual cost at farebox recovery and then the net cost, because it's going to be increase in ridership, is less than has already been given up with the Peak of the Peak, the Rock and Roll Marathon by opening 2 hours earlier this week, Friday Night Lights, as I call it, when we take away time for maintenance on the system, but we run trains for fewer people. And it's a decision that management and the board makes. And at the jurisdictional level, there is money that is spent on other things. We have spent money on the Signature Theater in Arlington County, which might have been spent on one more bus stop. It's a decision that's made at the board. And so what we're saying is the jurisdictions have to make a very difficult decision. We understand that, and I don't envy it, and I'm sure your discussion today is going to be like that. But at some point, you know, I hope that you'll take into account what you're all going to be in about 5 or 10 years, which is elderly. And if Mary keeps going the way she's going, we're not even talk about disability. And I hope I answered that, but I'll kick it over to. Right.
Are the counties and the cities, or most of the counties, shedding their responsibility for Medicaid, paratransit operations?
Yeah. Let Mark answer.
I was going to talk about this a little bit in the presentation. We have data that we're pretty confident in from the period in the 2000s. So we had from 2003 to 2010, we had total paratransit trips in the region that went up over 50%, from 4 million to about 6 million. The Human Services agencies carried less trips in 2010 than they did in 2003, whereas our from like 2.1 million down to 1.9 million. Our coverage went, our number of trips went from 900,000 to 2.something million. So there was, yes, there was, so in that period, we're clearly confident that there was movement between providers. More recently, we don't have that kind of, we're not positive where the people are coming from. We know that we're seeing an increase in trips to dialysis and to hospitals. We don't know exactly whether they're coming from Medicaid or from somewhere else yet, but we don't really care. That's why we're going after these pilot projects with the district and with the other jurisdictions aimed specifically at the dialysis patients.
Thank you.
Sure. Are there any other questions for Mr. Posner? Not, thank you so much, Mr. Posner and Ms. Walker, for coming and testifying before the committee regarding the budget. We'll move on to the discussion of the budget. I'd just like to say a few words and actually set some ground rules before we begin today's discussion. Now, first of all, I'd like to say that the adoption of a budget is one of the most important responsibilities of our board of directors. In fact, the decisions that this board will make regarding fares will affect all of our customers, and we do not take this decision lightly. I do think we may have some differences of opinion that may come out regarding different approaches and different things that we may want to try to do in terms of fares. And we may want to put four different options that we would want to consider. So all those are fair game for discussion. I would like to encourage all of you to raise your issues and your concerns and anything that you have to say during today's discussion. With respect to whether we're going to take a vote today regarding the budget, after having some discussions with some of our board members, we do feel it's important first to have a very deliberate discussion today to go through all the options and to consider the facts and also consider the consequences. If we decide to make changes to the general manager's proposal, there will be there may be impacts or consequences with regards to seeking other sources of revenue or looking out on the expense side of the budget in order to make everything whole at the end of the day. So as we're going through each part of the, especially with the fare proposal, we have to keep in mind if we drop the fares in one area, we may have to consider a fare change in another area, or we may have to consider expenses. So it is a package at the end of the day that we're going to adopt. So I do think we have to be cognizant of that as we're working through this, and that I will not be seeking a decision on any one matter until we have everything on the table for us to consider. So with that, in terms of the presentation, the staff will go through the changes since the general manager's original budget proposal of December. There were a couple changes made to the budget. They'll describe that. I'll give us an opportunity to discuss questions or raise questions about expenses since we need to kind of get through that piece first. And then when we come to the fares, they have slides on different aspects of the fare proposal. We'll stop after bus and rail to talk about that. We'll talk about miscellaneous increases such as parking, and then we'll talk about metro access. So there'll be opportunities to discuss each of those as we go through, and I'll stop the presentation so you can bring your issues to the table. So with that, are there any questions about the way we're going to proceed?
Yes, Mr. Nichols. If I could just ask one point of clarification. Mm-hmm. And thank you for your guidance and for your the explanation about the framework for moving forward. As we look forward at getting to closure and adopting a budget, can you just restate what our time frames are for getting the resolutions approved? Sure. To make sure that we're there? We obviously don't want to put ourselves in a position where we don't get things done. We also, as you said, want to be deliberative about the process. And what are we looking at for the board and for our stakeholders?
Depending on the board members' schedules, we may be looking at a special meeting before the March 27th meeting. That may occur before March 27th, obviously, but we can also be looking at March 27th, too. That is not my preference to have the committee meeting before a board meeting when we would adopt it. But I do need to have the secretary check people's calendars to see if that could happen. But I think we just need to take some of the pressure off in terms of making a decision today so we could have a fair and honest discussion about, the different ways we may want to approach fares and take that pressure off, because I think this is an important topic for the public.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? If not, I will ask Ms. Kissel to proceed with the staff presentation.
So it's been a long day, and so I want to make sure I'm concise but accurate and clear, and because it is a very important process that we're going through. So I'll take you through, Janice, if you just go to the agenda maybe, and I'll just flip to the agenda? Yep, okay, good. So last month, this committee actually reviewed and discussed the FAIR proposals. We discussed that at length. We also presented the outreach that we had to all of our stakeholders, the public hearing. We gave a preliminary view of the Title VI analysis, and then we had a larger discussion on some of the FAIR policies with respect to access. The agenda today is to just give you a framework for where we were in December on the general manager's budget, talk about a couple of slight changes that I'd like to just discuss within the context of the expense budget. That hasn't changed much. Most of those changes are with respect to organizational process, workforce development plan changes in terms of business proficiencies within our workforce. And I'll talk a little bit about that as well. Just to give some background, we spent an enormous amount of time, as you all well know, with our JCC, the jurisdictions, where we go through a lot of the detail associated with this budget. So in addition to the forum where we describe it here, we actually have a lot of meetings that we have with our JCC, our jurisdictions, as well as with the committees that you saw represented here today, the Writers Advisory Council and the Access Committee. If we go to Safer, Better, More, the budget continues to focus on these investments overall, improving on safety, improving on more reliable service, bus and rail, and obviously the operations of the Silver Line. And I won't go through some of these slides. I may just skip through, but because they're focused on the capital investment that we're making in the budget, the purpose of today's meeting is to talk a little bit more specifically on the operating budget, and we'll have a more broader discussion on the capital budget next month, the continuation of it. But as a reminder, the budget begins to invest in momentum, as you know, in the 8-car trains. It also has an investment on a lot of the NTSB investments. Work continues in that very critical safety environment, working to replace track circuits, power cables, a lot of the work that Rob Troop's area is doing, testing conditions and so forth. So that work is actually going on. In terms of improving safety and caring for customers, as you know, our budget has a broad programmatic view and investment in those areas, in the capital investment as well in the operating, and we're investing about $5 billion in investments for safety and state of good repair on the capital side. One of the areas that we're investing that implicates our operating budget is on our fatigue management program. As you know, we've had many discussions about that. Mr. Daugherty, our Chief Safety Officer, has presented to you over the last couple of months the details associated with that fatigue management program. We have a policy which provides a framework for the prevention and mitigation of fatigue, and is promoting the vigilance by developing and implementing a fatigue risk management program that we are well underway in developing. That's in our operating budget in FY15. In terms of quality service and connecting communities, there's a lot of things that are highlighted in our business plan that are associated with this. The bus priority corridor networks, continuous bus stop improvements, and you heard a little bit about that this morning in terms of bus stops, rail safety analysis, automatic train control operations. All of these capital investments have an impact on our operating. Escalator and elevator improve outage response time, increase accountability in terms of the geographic region with respect to that, rebuild our vertical transportation system through the replacement and the modernization program of escalators and elevators. Connecting communities, we have invested in connecting communities, and the investments there are including rail car expansion, test track, bus expansion, and so on. Those are all very big programs that are in our capital program that have an implication to our operating budget as well. If you look at the efficiency and the sustainability and Metro's employees, this has an implication in our operating budget in a couple of different ways. As you know, we have brought forward efficiencies and effectiveness programs, and we've talked about how that has saved some money as we put together our plan. We brought in McKinsey. We've actually established a process. We focused on areas where we can improve. As a reminder, the avoided costs on that are going to be $6 million on an NPV present value basis. We've looked at improving our non-revenue fleet. We do that by standardizing the fleet and actually doing a more fit for purpose. So basically, you know, fitting a vehicle for non-revenue for the purpose that you're using it. I know Jack Requa's area has done a lot of work in this area, and actually we've done more carpooling and more streamlining that's associated with that investment. In terms of the staff, Metro has, or actually in terms of sustainability, we have brought forward sustainability efforts that are also baked into our operating plan. We have actually established targets associated with energy, greenhouse, stormwater and waste, and that actually is built into our FY15 budget. We also have, as you know, awarded a zero-cost performance garage lighting program, which is actually going to replace 13,000 light fixtures in our garage, and that will be a very customer-enhancing, secure improvement in terms of maintenance going forward, as well as a sustainability program and efficiency. The human capital initiatives are very critical to our FY15 plan and beyond. We have focused an enormous amount of time and effort, I know Tanya Moore McGee has, with respect to, as well as the ELT, with respect to recruiting and training. Leadership development programs are in place in order to look at job-based leadership development programs from supervisor to the executive level, which actually will enhance the succession planning that we need to have at the authority. We're looking at competency, business competency, as well as job descriptions that describe those competency levels where we want to have people more higher functioning in a job than they are now. We're also providing a lot more career development and training for a lot of those business competency areas. I know Tanya and the ELT are working on more of a strategic plan for workforce development to assist the departments to identify the specific skill sets that are required in order to work at the authority as we modernize and rebuild to serve the customers that we have today. We have a performance management system in place, which clearly ties performance management of each individual to business plans, and those business plans are very tied to all of the authority's goals and objectives. We have had an employee engagement survey, and I know that we have reported out on that survey. It's been actually a year and a half or so ago. And we noticed a couple of areas where we wanted to improve with respect to leadership, respect for individuals, collaboration more with cross-functional departments. Those are in our plan going forward, and we have actually scheduled another employee engagement survey that'll occur in September of this year, and hoping actually to improve the ratings that we had on that employee engagement survey by the actions that we have taken place in this year's budget and then next year's budget. We also have developed wellness programs and will continue to develop the robust wellness programs that we need in order to really influence the workforce development that we have with the 13,000 employees that we have here today. We have focused efforts on exercise programs. We focus efforts on all sorts of programs, including healthy cooking demonstrations. Those are all very key programs to having a well workforce, which actually decreases absenteeism, which actually increases productivity, and actually is a very good cost savings as you look forward, look towards the future. And it's a sustainable effort that we're focusing on. I know the ELT, Tanya specifically, is driving the completion of the enterprise financial planning system with regard to the upgrade of the human capital system, and that will happen actually in the next couple of months, and I believe we'll probably report on that sometime in June or July, and we'll have successive efforts on the investment on upgrading our systems in the FY15 program as well. At the last committee meeting, and even prior to that, we've heard from the Chairman Downs, as well as many of the other committee board members, who wanted to have a broader focus on human capital. Rightly so, it is the largest cost that we have in our budget, and looking at it in the detail that was requested makes a lot of sense. We do that actually now, but we wanted to bring it to the forefront in a very comprehensive manner and very transparent in a budget forum. So this is just a very high-level picture of what will be more of a comprehensive look on how we look at cost associated with our labor. We'll look at pension, obviously, all the benefits that are associated with fringe benefits. And the positions that you see here from 2014 and 2015 are not just operating positions. They're actually the total of positions that we have in the authority. That would include capital and operating as well. Managing your workforce actually can create a lot of efficiencies, as you know, and we're actually very focused on the focused on that, as well as focusing on the risk mitigation plans that we would be putting in place in order to sort of manage that for the future. You can skip that next slide. The detail associated with the comprehensive human capital will be forefront in the budget book, and we're working on a framework for that now. I wanted to spend a bit of time talking about the changes since the general manager's budget in December. As you know, we've been working on changes to improve the budget in the discussions that we've had with the JCC and our external stakeholders, as well as our internal management, looking at ways to deliver the service in a more effective way, looking at ways to invest in areas where we can actually improve our competency levels of our workforce. So I'd like to share a couple of changes that we've made in that area that do not increase the expense of the general manager's budget in December, but actually just redistribute it so that we're able to focus on areas where we want to make the investment in a broader way. Management has initiated a review to establish a sustainable risk management framework. That has been ongoing work this year over the last 6 or 7 months. Headed by the general manager, the ELT has formed with the help of a consultant to actually develop a framework for how we talk about risk. There's no doubt that every ELT and leader here at Metro looks at risk on a daily basis. As they make decisions on investments, on workforce, on service delivery. What we are missing is a very comprehensive, coordinated risk framework where everyone uses a common language to describe what the risks are associated with Metro or an investment or a project or a program. And this framework actually helps us understand how to put that in place. So that is a change that will be in our FY15 budget. We'll initiate that risk management framework within the expense budget that we have in 15. And the thought process is to use that on a regular basis as we assess the risks of the authority. The thought process is also to use that as we develop our business plans going forward in FY16. And that will be a new enhancement, if you will, when we go towards the planning of our FY16 budget. The risk management framework, I will say, is I would arguably say that it's a culture change. As big as the effort that we've made on the safety culture here at Metro and the investments that we've made in that, and it's been very successful, the risk management structure and framework that we're looking to put in place will also be a cultural change here at Metro. So it'll be a start of that program in FY15. And you'll see it actually flourishing as we enhance it, develop it, deploy it in every aspect of our business going forward. The other change that we've made is in our workforce, building our core competency and business proficiency in our internal management and our staffing. As we rebuild Metro, looking at tracks and buses and infrastructure, we have got to also look at our workforce. They are the people who make it work. And so specifically, the areas that we're focused on in FY15 and beyond will be in contract and legal matters, procurement. You all know that our capital program has doubled over the last couple of years. As that investment raises, so too will be the all of the support work that is needed in order to affect a program of this magnitude. And so the business proficiencies that we need in this area, we've got to make that investment in this area. So I know Catherine Pett and I and Manage ELT have partnered on this and looked at ways that we can actually describe a program to better invest in the business process training that we need. We're looking at the National Transit Institute, which establishes they establish training for grantees. We're a grantee. So there's many programs out there that we can actually take advantage of and move to a more higher functioning organization, which is ready to deliver more transparency, accountability, and auditability in this important area. So that is a major change that we'll be making in the investment in FY15, and it's central to building a best practice in this area. The only other change, besides those two big changes, the other change is we have a change to our reimbursable budget with respect to the $8.3 million due to reconciliation of grants, and we actually are looking for more safety and security grants to support the MTPD. That's a more reimbursable project, so it doesn't affect our operating levels as well. So I wanted to stop here before we get into the revenue discussion, which Mark will carry and Tom, and ask if there's any particular questions that we can address on the expense side or any of the programs that I described.
Thank you, Ms. Kisler. Are there any questions of staff regarding anything you heard today? No? Okay. So I want to move on to the revenue discussion. Mr. Schofield.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I want to do first is to talk about changes to the revenue and ridership forecasts since the proposal in December, then talk a little bit about changes to the subsidy allocation to the jurisdictions, and then we'll get into the fare proposals. And like the chairman said, we can talk about rail and bus, and then we can talk about parking, and then we can talk about metro access. The biggest change on the revenue side since December is due to the fact that the federal transit benefit has not yet been renewed at the higher number of approximately $250 a month and has reverted back to the lower level of $130 a month. Our staff are obviously working with the local delegations, with groups to lobby to get that benefit back up and back to parity with the parking benefit. We don't have a timeline for that now, and I think it's prudent to think that we will be at the beginning of FY15 with the benefit at the lower value. So in response to that, we have eliminated the 1% growth assumption that we had in the December proposal for rail. If we take that out, that reduces our revenue forecast by approximately $6 million. We will not see that growth in rail as a result of the reduced benefit. We do, however, have a total of $1 million in revenue to add back into the forecast. Approximately $500,000 added to the forecast for advertising as a result of the new contract we've signed, which has a higher minimum guarantee. And we do hope that by FY16, we'll be seeing the benefit of the digital advertising parts of that contract, and we can bring that number up even further. And then a net addition of approximately $500,000 to bus revenue, more revenue that's associated with the service that DHS contracts with us for service out to the Coast Guard facility, and a little bit less revenue from the DC school program. Now that we have some more months of experience with that program, we just realized that the projection we had in the December proposal was a little bit too high. So those two things would net to plus $500,000. So with the minus six and the plus half and the plus half, a net reduction in the operating revenues compared to December of $5 million. So then we have the changes to the subsidy allocation. We had to add approximately $90,000 to the jurisdictional billing for the debt service that's associated with our 2009 Build America bonds. These are tax-advantaged bonds that we get refundable credits for, but as a result of sequestration, our refundable credit payment was reduced by approximately 9%, and so that $90,000 credit, which we didn't get, has to be made up by the jurisdictions. So that's been added back to the subsidy calculation, proportional to the amount of debt service that each jurisdiction has. More substantively, that's a pretty small amount. More substantively, looking ahead for the rest of this fiscal year, we have recommended reserving $10 million out of the FY 2013 surplus to address potential contingencies in fiscal 14. These are mostly related to the negative revenue impacts associated with the delay in the Silver Line, the winter weather that we've had, and then the government shutdown in October. So if we do reserve that $10 million, that leaves $20 million from the prior year surplus that can be used to offset jurisdictional contributions in fiscal 15. That's an increase of $5 million up from the December proposal, which only assumed $15 million. We also, and we've worked with the JCC on this, we have updated the subsidy allocation with the very latest bus miles and hours data. And so the jurisdictional distribution has been tweaked a little bit from what you saw in December. But so to sum up, we've taken a net $5 million in revenues out, but we have increased the usage of the prior year surplus by $5 million so that the total contribution from the jurisdictions remains at the same number as December, $779 million. So, on to fares. We've talked through these options in... Oh, yeah.
Sure. Go ahead and ask questions about...
Oh, yeah, sure,
about
absolutely.
About the subsidy. Sure. Anybody else? Or do you want to talk about the fares itself or the...
No, I want to talk about the subsidies and the changes to the budget.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Sure.
That's
sure.
The appropriate time to do that.
Yes,
now.
Yes, please raise your question.
Okay. Just to put this in context, could we turn to the chart that shows FY 2015 operating budget, which is a little, it's page 49 in the set. I guess it's about 10 slides further on.
This one?
That is the one. That
okay.
is the one.
Yes.
I'm just trying to understand what you've said. So,
oh, sure.
Essentially, on the top, the total revenue line, what you're saying is that the prior projection would have had $5 million more in that for a total of 953.
953 rather than 948.
And then so to balance that minus $5 million, what you've done is, maybe you should explain what you've done on the bottom line.
Sure. You're exactly right. In the December proposal, the total revenue rather than 948 was at 953. The total expenses were the same at 1757. That net $5 million reduction in revenue is balanced by an increase in that line that says prior year surplus. Where it had been $15 million in December, it's now been bumped up to $20
million.
Yep.
And so that keeps the total subsidy requirement the same as what was projected in the earlier budget. Now, you made no change, as you just stated, to the 1.75 total expenses.
That's right.
Why is that?
The projections that we had in December have not changed, and the changes that Mrs. Kissel was talking about as far as the business proficiency initiatives, that's a net zero change. We've just moved some of the funding from one area to another in order to accomplish that.
So there would be no change in the number of employees and no change in other expense items.
And we've also, this is, as far as the subsidy allocation, the expenses by mode have also stayed the same, so that hasn't changed in the interim as well.
Now, I think I understand why the number of employees wouldn't change, even though you have less revenue. But I'm not so sure I quite follow that when you talk about non-personnel costs. So let me first ask, what is all included in non-personnel costs?
Well, I can give you the high level, and I might then turn it over to Tom to give a little more detail. Things like propulsion, fuel, and utilities, services, materials and supplies, all of those sort of major categories would go into non-personnel costs.
And what do you mean by services?
Contracts that we have with third-party providers.
Okay. Well, one of the biggest services, one of the biggest is Metro Access, which is about $100 million a year. And so that would be considered a non-personnel cost.
You're anticipating my next question. So within the non-personnel cost is the Metro Access cost. And that number for Metro Access is?
$105 million.
Okay, and earlier, Mr. Kent, this morning, I think you had testified or stated that the Metroxas cost per trip is about $56. Is that correct?
50, yes, sir.
50? Mm-hmm. And so what would be the, I don't have to do the multiplication, what's the forecast for the number of Metroxas trips in FY15 to get us to the $105 million?
We're at about 2.1 million for FY15.
2.1 million trips.
Right.
And what does that reflect as an increase from FY2014 in terms of both trips and dollars?
As an increase over the FY14 budget, it's about a 6% increase, I believe.
6% increase.
Yeah.
Okay. And of those non-personnel costs, so you've identified the $105 million for Metroxas, which roughly one-fifth. Could you just identify what would be the other big category of non-personnel costs? What would be the next big high hit there?
So, I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Of the $483 million, what's the biggest single item?
Okay. After Metroxas, materials and supplies would be the next biggest. Fuel and propulsion are also a large expense category.
Okay, and what are those two, materials and supply and propulsion?
So our in the non-personnel category, our materials and supplies budget is $106 million proposed. Fuel and propulsion power is about approximately $90 million. Utilities are approximately $40 million. And there are several other smaller categories.
I just wanted to sort of get a sense of the big three that were included in that $483 million. Thank you. That's very helpful, and I think it'll be very useful in the discussion we're going to have later on this afternoon. Thank you.
Okay, why don't we move on to bus and rail fares?
So the options that we are currently bringing forward to the committee are based on the discussions that we've had with the jurisdictional staff in the budget work sessions that we've had over the last few weeks and months. And they represent what we felt had the broadest support among the jurisdictional members. That's not to say that it was necessarily unanimous, just that it had sort of the broadest support. We understand, of course, that the committee may want to consider additional changes within the broader set of possible changes that are laid out by the docket. We're prepared to talk about the revenue impacts of those now, and if we need to turn around any changes for future meetings, we're certainly prepared to do that as well. So what we're bringing forward today is the 3% increase in rail that's applied to the base fare, the mileage, and the max fare for both the peak and the off-peak, to impose a 15% cap on any increases for those off-peak mid-distance trips. Those are generally in the 6 to 10-mile range. If you recall, we had a similar cap back in FY13 when we made those changes to the off-peak fare structure so that it was approximately a 25% discount off of the peak. In order to prevent those particular riders from facing very large fare increases, and we are, again, proposing to do that. And we also are bringing forward the discounted convention pass. Given the long lead time in terms of planning and working with the conventions, we'll be treating this as a pilot program in FY15, and then, like the digital advertising, hopefully we can attribute some solid revenue to that in fiscal 16. And then for bus, the $1.75 base Smart Trip fare, and then retaining the cash surcharge in order to not lose any penetration on the Smart Trip card usage, and raising that fare to $2.
Mr. Cox,
so with that, I will pause.
May I ask, as we go through this, if you could say how these differ from the general manager's proposal from December?
Sure.
That may prevent some questions.
Absolutely. The rail is essentially what the general manager proposed. We did not have the convention pass in there officially in his proposal, but then we had it in time for the docket. The general manager had proposed that the cash fare would be $1.75, equal to the smart trip fare. But based on our discussions with the jurisdictions, it seemed that keeping the cash surcharge and having it be at $2 had the broadest support. And so we've changed that from the general manager's proposal.
Thank you. Open up for discussion.
Yeah, I would just like to ask the jurisdictions who think that we should raise the bus fares more than what the general manager asked for to kind of state that rationale. Because that's certainly not the districts. It's not something that I've put out there, and I think it should be a discussion for the public record.
I don't know if any specific board member wants to respond to that, but did you hear the rationale from the JCC? Can you characterize kind of the conversations that were had at the JCC from each of the jurisdictions?
Sure. I think it sort of just boils down into two pieces. One is, again, with respect to the Smart Trip card, we have put a lot of effort into encouraging the penetration of that, the usage of that, and this was actually mentioned by the RAC in their comments here as well, that we don't want to appear to be sort of backing away from that. And then the other one is just that keeping the cash surcharge generates a little bit of additional revenue, and when you're looking for revenue, that's one place to go.
I just want to add, we actually reduced the price of the Smart Trip card, as you recall, to $2. And I think we're actually looking this FY15 once we make the Smart Trip cards more available at.
But Ms. Kessel, I thought that the argument, now correct me if I'm wrong, that we just had last December was that didn't happen, that we didn't actually move people, and we didn't see that having the two separate, and maybe I'm not remembering,
I think you're correct.
We didn't achieve that goal.
The discussion was that we achieved most of the transfer of people onto Smart Trip Card when we took care of the transfer prices several years ago, and that we saw very little change with the surcharge. The concern also, there was two things that drove that recommendation. One was that a number of customers, because they're very modest means, could not afford to put a lot of money on a Smart Trip card, and therefore what they were doing is getting on the bus, loading enough fare for that, so that was actually slowing down our loading times. That was one reason for proposing that. The second was the folks, again, that use cash fare, there was a somewhat higher proportion of them that were of modest income. There was also people, tourists. And the third was just another simplification of the fare. That was the rationale when I put that forward.
But I did, in the staff, if that's the staff's recommendation to the general manager, but does the staff have these recommendations from the jurisdictions that demonstrate a jurisdictional commitment? Because this is really the appropriate place.
What Mark stated was JCC's, sort of the general consensus of what the JCC input was to this fair proposal.
Okay. So I would be interested in hearing from the board members about their thoughts about it.
Kathy?
I think we've always been at the rationale that you ascribe to, Ms. Bowser, in terms of who the cash fare impacts and how the Smart Trip card requires the additional money. And I think my part is, one, can we disaggregate that the population that is more strained by the cost of a transit cost versus the visitor amount. The number of folks that find it just easier to just get a paper card and think they're not going to ever come back to Metro again, and that funding. and it would be interesting to disaggregate that data first, and then I have another
I think
comment.
That's in the disparate impact analysis. I think that's what we call it, which shows the proportion of low-income people using the smart trip card on and buses as bus customers versus those who are using the cash. And I think what you see, without me turning around looking at it, is there is a slightly, somewhat higher percentage of low-income people using the cash fare than there is for the smart trip card.
That's right.
I think my question was a little bit, well, but I think what we're looking at most often is just low-income, cash fare, smart trip, and the other. But do we get a chance to look at any other that may reflect tourist population, and that is where you see that cash fare? Sure. So you have it.
Again, it's certainly, yes. We know that tourists use, I see it all the time, depending on the city, the card because they're making a, you know, just one or two trips. Mm-hmm. But when you again look at the number, the percentage of people that are low income, it's a somewhat higher percentage than the general population using smart trip cards on bus.
Mr. Downs?
I know I've said this before. I'll say it again because it's, I think it's worth repeating. We don't have a story that is understandable, and I think part of what Ms. Bowser's reluctance here is our previous round of fare increases had a larger increase on bus than rail. This time we have a 9%, and with the cash surcharge, it would be over 10% increase on average, according to the documents that you all had presented. And I'm not sure what we tell as the story. Why is it 10% on bus and 3% on rail? Is it because bus ridership is increasing and that's where the money is? It's kind of like Dillinger, we're going there because he robbed banks because it's where they kept the money. Is it because bus service customers tend to be less responsive to increases in fares because they have fewer choices about other modes of transportation? In the district, I think about 70-some-odd percent of district bus riders have no access to an automobile. So those are two of the possible explanations about why it's, say, 10% bus and 3% rail. But absent a story that we can explain the differential, it's very hard to explain this to bus customers. And if there is a better explanation, we should have it on the table.
Well, I think what I said when I made my presentation, or we made the presentation, the general manager's budget, was that you look back 10, 12 years ago, the bus fare tracked the base rail fare. Then there was a series of decisions made over some years in that decade where that there was a disconnection between the two, and the rail fares went up and the bus fares didn't, or they went up at a lesser rate. And what we did in the last fare, and what we're attempting to do here basically is to bring the, to make up for a little bit of that disparity that occurred, because don't forget there are low-income people that ride rail also. We're pushing in the direction of having the, to make a policy connection again, to have the discounted base rail fare approximately equal the bus fare. And that's where we came to here. So you had the rail fares going up over years, the bus fares didn't go up over years, and created that disconnect. There was really no policy for that.
You're not talking about the 7 years where there was no fare increase on bus or rail, are you?
Well, that's part of it, but again, there was a disconnect.
So there was no disconnect there between bus and rail for those 7 years where there was no increase in fares.
But if you look over a longer time period, and that's what we looked over, as I recall, we saw that the policy had been of the board in that time frame, that the base rail fare was connected to the bus fare. And then in that decade or more, that there became a disconnect, and that no longer followed. And the decision was made, and you know, for good reasons, I'm sure, that the bus fare would be kept lower while the rail fare continued to increase. So this began, and in fact, I think one of the years I was first here, that we held the bus fare and we moved up the rail fare. So that's the story. It was to bring it more back in line. What you're seeing basically is, and for good reason, is with the bus fares being held lower and for also improving the buses, it's going up. The whereas the folks who are riding the rail, have suffered over the longer term and exaggerated by the reduction by Congress in the smart benefits and in transit benefit, a significant increase for the rail side. So what you have is the rail side, which is the most efficient way to carry passengers, has the highest cost recovery ratio.
I don't think I have a problem with the logic that you described, but all of that was true in December when you made the recommendation. All of that was true. And it was your recommendation that we eliminate the cash price. And the only thing in my mind that has changed is that other people around the table who aren't saying so now said, let's get some more money, as you said, from the bus riders. That's the only thing that's changed. And so that's not good enough reason to say, well, they're going to pay cash anyway, so what's the difference between $2 and that? Well, it does make a difference over the course of a year, over the course of a month. It makes a real difference. And we, frankly, you haven't provided to me a logical reason to do that, other than that's another way for us to raise some money, and we need money. That's, to me, that's not a good enough reason. So unless there's something I'm missing, I'm still where I was when you presented it. Did it seem like a good idea? You've made no other arguments to me that would suggest that it moves, other than, well, it's a good place to get some more money.
I think Ms. Hudgens had a comment.
Since Mr. Sarles went back to the history, I'll go back to the history too. And I think one of the concerns that I always had in those discussions is that the assumption is low income is bus and rail is not. And I have to tell you, since I see a cross-section of travel that comes into the district and goes out of the district, they're the same folks. And so I think our goal ought to be, how do we bring the level of equity in terms of the share of the transit costs to the customer in a balanced way. If you assume that the bus rider will be only low income and you hold it steady, you do lose track in terms of what the share will be. Do you have an imbalance in the share? But I think the greater part is what needs to be in this larger discussion is, what are the combination of shares of modes that all folks take, and what does that cost come out to be in sharing? And I think I experience and see a lot of that combinations that occur when it's both bus and rail, or rail, and it's long distance rail. So I think it is a concern that we should be very careful as to maybe how we use and balance the cash fare, or how we balance the bus fare. I think it's until we can empirically show that it's only bus that's there and being impacted, I think the improvement is that there's a lot of use of bus service now because people find a better service that's allowing them to connect around some areas. And that's a good news piece. But it also is important to recognize that I believe that there are a lot of folks paying rail prices that have over time gone very high and has a disproportion.
Mr. Acosta, perhaps, there's a number of ways to look at this, and I appreciate your perspective, Ms. Bowser. I would say for my jurisdiction, Part of what matters here is when we make the change and what other tools are available to people when they make the change. And there's a small proportion of people who are regular riders who are still using cash. And I feel like we have some obligation here to try to move them to Smart Trip. What worries me at the moment about giving up on the cash surcharge is that the incentive to move to Smart Trip goes away. And to the extent that people then go back, more and more people go back to using cash, we're back into the dilemma we were in when we started of everybody loading on the bus or everybody paying when they get on the bus and of managing the cash. We have a new payment system coming in another year or so that will put more tools in people's hands. And I think for our part, we just feel like let's keep what we have for another year here. So when the new payment system comes in, if we're ready to make the move, then that's fine. We can put some different kinds of fare media and other things in people's hands. I also think we still need to continue to work to make sure that the capacity to load Smart Trip in a variety of different places along our major bus routes continues to increase, and I don't feel like we're there on that yet, and I think the incentive goes away to fix that if we take away that cash surcharge because our customers aren't asking for it anymore either. So for me, this is a no change at the moment in anticipation of a bigger, better change coming.
Mr. Goldman.
Thank you. I wanted to align myself with the same views on that. This does provide, in my view, and I think my colleagues from Maryland's view, an incentive to move to the Smart Trip card, and so we should keep the cash surcharge for now. But I did want to use this opportunity to just state some broader principles that I will use in analyzing these changes, since this is my first opportunity to vote on fare increase changes since I was not here 2 years ago. My views may be totally out of line with how people have looked at these views in the past, but the way I look at these kind of changes at this point is that generally I think I'm in agreement with the revised proposal coming out of the general manager, and that would be sort of my lodestone here as we go through this conversation on changes. To the extent that members are going to suggest changes, I guess I would ask them, to paraphrase Tom Cruise, where's the money? You know, what's the pay for that goes with your proposed change? If you're going to suggest that we do away with the cash surcharge, that means that there's a need for some more revenue someplace. And as my colloquy with Mark indicated, what the staff went through is they realized they had lost $5 million in revenue going forward for FY17, and so they came and found a place to replace that $5 million so that budget going forward basically stayed in balance with the same sort of burden on the various jurisdictions in terms of subsidy. And then I went through another colloquy with him pointing out that, you know, okay, if you're going to make a change, where does it come from? Well, obviously there's sort of three places where if you're going to propose a reduction in revenue, where it can come from. It can obviously come from the $1.7 billion in expenses that Mark didn't make any changes on. It can come from some change in revenue. Essentially, we've put out for a public hearing a potential rail fare increase up to 4%, but the manager's general manager's proposal is for 3%. Are people suggesting that rail riders should pay more to cover the cost of some reduction in the surcharge for bus passengers, or it could come out of an increase in subsidy? But I think it's incumbent upon members who are proposing some reduction in revenue, some change that will reduce revenue, to indicate where they're proposing that the revenue, you know, be replaced. And that's what I will be looking for as I try to analyze some of these proposals. Is there a way to pay for that, and what is the way that that's being proposed to be paid for. Thank you.
Spencer.
Yes, well, certainly to Mr. Goldman's point, I'm familiar with the budgeting process and recognize that there's a certain amount that's needed to run the system. And if the revenue adjustments are downward since then we'll find it. And that's what we'll do. But I don't want anybody to suggest that we had the general manager come and say very specifically that the idea of this cash surcharge hasn't gotten us any operational benefit. That's what he said. No operational benefit to moving people to the Smart Trip card. So let's just be clear. That's not the reason. The reason is you want more money and you want it to come from the bus riders. And that's a fair position to have. But don't make it because you think that you're getting some operational benefit from Smart Trip because it hasn't been shown on the bus. It just hasn't.
I appreciate, Mr. Goldman, you laying out what you think, and I guess I want to push your question back at you about where does the money come from, because my understanding is that the increase for the Prince George's parking cancels out any increase here from the cash from the $2 cash fare. And as far as I'm aware, Maryland hasn't identified a place to cover that. So I would just push that question back to you and say, you know, it's fair for you to ask it of all of us. We ask it back of you.
Any other comments?
Taking advantage of the time with my colleague from PG isn't here, but we will get a response to you and we'll put that.
It's a serious question.
It is, and it's a legitimate question.
So just to, let me see if I can recap where we're at. I haven't heard any issues or relative to the rail fare increase. Is that correct?
Depends on the rest of the package,
I understand,
as you
but
said.
As of now, I mean, nobody's raising
We have a bunch of PAYGO questions coming.
Correct. And we'll get to
access.
That in the next part, which is parking, which you raised, as well as Metro Access. Then we still have an outstanding question about the bus surcharge. At this point. So why don't we move on to the next slide.
So the parking fare adjustments that we're coming forward with are relatively straightforward, I think, including the 25-cent daily increase at all the Metro parking facilities, including the 50-cent surcharge increase at Prince George's County facilities, and approving the reduction in the event parking for the stations near FedEx Field, to see if we can stimulate some more usage for those facilities. Sure. That the 25-cent increase was in the general manager's December proposal. The 50-cent increase was not. That has been added since then at the request of Prince George's County. And the reduction in the event parking was in the general manager's proposal. I also just want to draw attention to the fact that we have the word most in there in the second bullet. We have been advised by the Maryland jurisdictional staff that if the 50-cent surcharge for Prince George's is approved, that they would like to have that surcharge not be applied at Landover, Prince George's Plaza, and Addison Road, which are the lowest utilization facilities in the county. So the surcharge would apply at 12 out of the 15 facilities in the county.
All right. Are there, Panda, you raised a issue about Prince George's County's surcharge. Are there any other questions or issues or concerns that anybody would like to make regarding this list? Ms. Hudgens.
I wanted to express the concern that's raised regarding the parking increase. The increase in parking, if we'll have the same discussion as to what rider impact it has, if you take the long distance rider, and in some instances, the long distance rider is a parker, b a bus rider, and three a rail rider, and so the increase becomes I think higher than average if you take each of those modes separately, and it is one that I think right now, if I'm looking at maintaining ridership on the new Silver Line, I think there really will be shell shock in terms of what folks experience in that they are moving from free parking to not only the current parking that exists today, if they calculate it what they know, but what they will see is an increase, as well as an increase in fare in both bus and rail. So I think there is a concern, and how do we move and continue both the ridership increase that we want, as well as the balance in terms of how we make the transition to the new rail line.
Okay, so you're stating a concern about the 25-cent daily increase that's being proposed. Okay.
What is the revenue tied to the 25-cent increase?
We have put that revenue into the general manager's proposal at about $1.5 million. That's a relatively conservative estimate. If you just do the straight math, it's more like $2.5 to $2.6 million. But for exactly the reasons that Ms. Hudgens noted, that especially because you're dealing with a population that sort of by definition has access to a car, and so when they face the increase from both the parking and the rail, and they have access to a car, they may on the margin say, I think I'll drive. So we intentionally put that number a little bit lower.
So somewhere between $1.5 and $2.5 million.
$2.5 million would be sort of the straight calculation. We have it in the general manager's proposal at $1.5 million.
Mr. Dyke.
Just briefly to say that I support Kathy's position on that, although I'd to keep open the option that as we look at the different components, because there's something that's coming up that I would propose a reduction in revenue, and if we have to look there for additional monies, I'd certainly come back to it, but I am support what my colleague from Virginia had to say on that.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments?
Only a comment that, sure. As I said earlier to Ms. Hudgens, that it's hard to I understand the combination trip issue, particularly for long-distance commuters, but it's on its face, it's hard to have a significant increase in bus, an increase in rail, and no increase in parking. It's just particularly.
What do those guys get? $250 a month?
Worth of parking the parking subsidy guys. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Anyway. Anyway, just a passing comment.
Thank you, Mr. Downs.
Mr. Costa.
Yes, Ms. Hines.
Could we just have the cost of the 50-cent surcharge, the impact on the budget of the 50-cent surcharge?
Yeah. So our estimates are that that would generate, and this is not part of the operating budget, that would generate approximately $2 million a year for Prince George's County, but that because to the rider in Prince George's County who sees potentially a 75-cent increase, that would cost the operating budget for Metro approximately $1 million. And I was actually in the very next slide going to make the comment that you made, Ms. Hines, that approximately washes out with the $1 million revenue increase from the cash surcharge on bus.
Cash surcharge, yes, ma'am. Is $1 million.
Yes.
Give or take. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions regarding this slide? Okay. Let's move on to Metro Access.
I was just going to pause and sort of make a wrap-up here. If you were to do all of these things and if you were to not change the Metro Access fares, which is obviously where we're headed next, but the total revenue increase would be approximately $30 million, which is about the same as what the general manager proposed in December, with the gain from the bus surcharge offsetting the loss from the Prince George's County parking surcharge. If this were adopted as it's being brought forward right now, this would pass the final Title VI equity analysis. As we indicated at the last meeting, more broadly, as long as the bus fare is not at $1.85, as long as it's at $1.75, most of the other changes that have been discussed here would not be a problem from a Title VI perspective.
Thank you.
So, in the Metro Access discussion, this is sort of a two-parter. First, I want to address some of the issues that came up at the public hearings and that came up during our last committee meetings. I want to provide some clarity on some of those issues, and then hopefully that will set the stage for the second part of the discussion to think about the Metro Access fares not just for fiscal 15, but for the longer term, and to sort of talk a little more explicitly about whether we're potentially going to change our philosophy for pricing Metro Access. So we got a little bit wrapped around the axle on this one last time, so I just want to be sort of very clear. The current proposal, no change in the policy of pricing at twice the fastest comparable fixed route with a cap at $7. If that were to be put in place, here's what you would see for all the different modes, and then for metro access, and then for system-wide. So about a 9.6% increase for bus. It's a little bit higher than 9.4 because you have the cash surcharge included in this one. Rail is at 3.2, a little bit higher than 3.0 because you have some of those mid-distance off-peak trips that are going up a little bit more. We put it in here for comparison. Your average sort of bus plus rail with a transfer between the two would see an increase of about 6%. That would depend a little bit. It would change a little bit depending on whether you're talking about a longer or a shorter rail trip, but in general it would be about 6%. The parking, if you include the Prince George's County surcharge, would be 9% overall, but that would be more like 5% for most jurisdictions, and then I believe 16 or 17% for Prince George's County. And then for Metro Access, 5.4%, which compares very nearly the same as sort of the weighted system-wide average that all the users are going to feel, which is about 4.9%. Now, granted, it is absolutely true that it won't be an even 5% across all the Metro Access users. The folks who are taking the trips that are priced at twice bus, currently $3.20, they'll see that same 9.4% increase that the bus riders will see going up to $3.50. Folks who are at the other end who are taking the max fare trips now, they'll see no increase, and then the folks who are in the middle will see something in the middle. So that 5.4% is certainly just the average across the whole population. So the fare calculator, because there was a lot of concern about the perception of variability of fares. What I think the real challenge is with the fare calculator is that it has two components, and there's only one of those components is visible to our riders. So the first piece on the left is the trip characteristics, the date, the time, the pickup and drop-off location, and then the second piece on the right is the rail and the bus schedules, which they can't see. And if you make changes to either side, then you have a potential to get a different quoted fare. So if you make a trip from A to B at 1 p.m. on a Tuesday, and then you make that same trip from A to B at 1:30 p.m. on a Tuesday, you may get a different fare depending on exactly what the bus and rail schedules are. We understand that that can be a little frustrating, but that is the system working as it's intended. But a month later, you might make that same A to B trip at 1 p.m. on a Tuesday, and you might get a different fare because the schedules have changed in over that month. And the critical point here, I think, is we don't have a separate trip planner for Metro Access. We use the very same database that you or I would use if we go online to plan a trip that goes into the fare calculator for Metro Access. And we are updating that trip planner regularly to put the very latest data in there for the customers. So not just the major quarterly changes to bus routes, we're going in there and putting in bus detours, and we are, I think, probably most importantly, each week we're going in there and putting in the updated data about the weekend track work. So if those schedules are changing, even if you put in the exact same trip characteristics, you may get a different quoted trip coming out of the calculator. You also can get results that are sort of counterintuitive, and I actually heard a Metro Access customer talking about this at one of the public hearings that I attended back in January. Making a trip in the peak may be cheaper than making a trip in the off-peak, which doesn't sound right, right? Like, rail trips are more expensive in the peak, and bus trips cost the same regardless. But our bus service has much higher frequency and much wider coverage during the peak. So the fastest comparable trip in the peak may be on the bus, and then when you go to ask for that trip in the off-peak and the bus is only running once an hour or maybe is not even running at all, the calculator may put you on rail, and then the trip costs may be higher. And again, you know, we understand that this can be frustrating, but the system is designed to be compliant with the ADA and always be up to date in determining the comparable trip. So, we also talked a little bit about travel time comparability. I don't want to get into the weeds on this. Christian can, if we need to talk about this later, certainly Christian can assist. But ensuring the comparability of our paratransit travel times with the fixed route is covered extensively in the federal requirements, both the ADA and then the Code of Federal Regulations. So the paratransit travel time from A to B has to be compared to the door-to-door fixed route trip from A to B, and that includes walking, waiting, traveling, walking again, and then a buffer is added in there as well that is mode-specific, bus versus rail, and specific to the Washington region, and it's approved by the FTA, that recognizes both the shared ride nature of paratransit, that you may not be going directly to your destination because there may be another person in the vehicle with you, and also just the general transportation characteristics of the Washington region. This is information that we present regularly. We presented it to the AAC in August, and using data from April of 2013, we were compliant in terms of travel time comparability for almost 99% of our trips. So that, you know, in doing that calculation, our paratransit travel time was less than or equal to the comparable fixed route travel time. We actually talked a little bit already about the market share trends, so I think I'll jump past this one and just talk a little bit about price sensitivity, because there have been some questions about that as well. In general, we do expect that Metro Access riders would be less price sensitive than our bus and rail riders. They, in general, are more dependent on our services, and they're taking more non-discretionary trips, like medical trips. History bears out that assumption, and the general manager's budget assumes a very low elasticity for the current proposed fare increase. We don't think it's wise to assume that we're going to get big cost savings because fewer people are taking trips as a result of this fare increase. But to reiterate what we had talked about at the previous meeting, when we had our big policy change, you know, we saw overall a 12% drop in ridership from fiscal 10 to fiscal 12, and all those policy changes happened sort of throughout fiscal 2011. But those changes to the corridor and the changes to our demand management policies, those impacts were relatively small and occurred over time. I mean, since we grandfathered all those folks in with, you know, the change in the corridor, that's not something that's even going to pay off until, you know, sort of a long ways down the road. The fare increase, though, happened all at once, and for some riders it was very large. You know, for some riders it was more than a doubling of their fare. It's been estimated again that approximately 10% of that 12% drop was due to the change from going to twice bus to twice the fastest comparable fixed route. And so we have used that number, and we'll get to that in just a bit, as sort of the place to start in terms of calculating what we think would happen if we were to change our pricing going forward. So now that we've had all that scene setting, we had a situation in the 2000s where we had an unsustainable cost curve. We were growing on average 15% a year during that period in terms of cost for paratransit. We chose to change our pricing philosophy along with the other changes. And we were able to achieve some noticeable mitigation in terms of costs over the next few years. But usage is rising again. Price is not available to us as a tool this time. We are essentially maxed out in terms of what the Americans with Disabilities Act allows us to charge. That's why we've been pursuing other routes to, you know, these regional partnerships and other efforts to balance our demand. And so now the question that faces us, are we also going to consider a change in our philosophy on pricing? As we head into fiscal 15, but not just fiscal 15, I think we need to think about what's the impact down the road. So the AAC fare proposals, which I think you all have seen, they listed three of them. Their first preferred was to go back to the two times bus, the prior policy. The second was to reduce the multiplier, and the third was to reduce the cap. So for any of these proposals, there are sort of two different budgetary impacts. One is the revenue that we would lose on our existing trips, and then the second is the subsidy increase that we would be associated with any new trips. If the changes to the policy are relatively small, then those two pieces are probably going to be about the same size. If you're talking larger changes, the subsidy increase is really going to be the more dominant piece of that calculation. So as I said, the AAC's preferred change is to return to the prior policy of two times the bus fare, which is, with a few exceptions, essentially a flat fare. Our estimate is that on existing trips, that would be a revenue loss of approximately $2 million out of the $8 million roughly that we currently get from Metro Access. And in addition, we project that the 10% loss that we had when we made that policy change back in 2011 would be reversed, so that we would gain approximately 10% more trips for an additional added subsidy of approximately $10 million, assuming, again, the current $50 a trip for Metro Access. So taken together, those are about $12 million. I don't want to claim that we have a lot of precision on this. These are fairly rough estimates. So what I've said up here is that the net subsidy increase would be greater than $10 million. Their second proposal would be to reduce the multiplier to something like 1.5 or 1.25 from the current value of 2. If we were to change the multiplier to 1.5, that would be an average fare decrease for all the Metro Access customers of about 13%. So we estimate that we would lose, again, about $1 million in fare revenue on the existing customers, or on the existing trips, rather, sorry. And that we would then require another $5 or $6 million in added subsidy for new trips. So again, the total would be $6 to $7 million. Again, not wanting to claim a ton of precision on this, we have up here that it would be in the range of $5 to $10 million for the increase in the net subsidy. As the multiplier goes lower, the subsidy increase would be larger. The question was raised at the previous meeting, what sort of a multiplier would give an average fare increase that was equal to the average fare increase for rail? And the answer to that is approximately 1.9, so a small drop down from the current 2 times. And then finally, the AAC had proposed a lowering of the cap from $7 to $6.50. This would have the least influence on the subsidy, an increase of less than $1 million compared to the general manager's current proposal. This figure is a little bit lower than the draft number that we gave to the JCC. We refined this number between then and now. And with that,
thank you, Mr. Schofield. I'll open it up for discussion. Ms. Sines?
Thanks, Mr. Costa. So I think our conversation is in the right place, which is, what is our policy? How do we want to think about this going forward? I appreciated Mr. Posner sort of raising the issue of whatever we do has to have some sustainability and some replicability as we think about the future. And it is for that reason that I think we should be looking at the multiplier and not at the cap, because I think there's only so much space in which you can lower the cap, and then you're at the same place. And then what happens if we raise the cap? Are we, you know, it doesn't have as much defensibility. The way I look at what has happened on this is that there was a tremendous amount of effort put into the reset that happened when the board decided to go to the 2 times the fastest and did all that work to kind of pull this back and align it more with ADA. And we've had basically 4 years of somewhat, you know, not a whole bunch of change around that, or two, however long. You didn't implement it till 11, right? So you've had 2.5, 3 years of sustainability around that. And now we're looking again at raising fares, and the question is, having done the great reset, how do you advance in some sort of parallel fashion? And to me, that means you have to find a way to look at this increase in relation to the rest of the increase that's being asked for in the, from other riders, from other parts of our service, and say we are going to all move forward together. But we have to find the right mechanism. And so I appreciate the work that staff has done. You know, I pulled the rail fare out of the air last time, and I think what it shows is, you know, we're close, we're not exactly on, but the rail fare is generally on a higher base than the bus fare is, and so to me it makes some sense. But I would say, and I would say this for Virginia, we're more comfortable with this as a philosophy moving forward to try to do something that adjusts in this manner than to simply lower a cap, which the cap was arbitrarily chosen when it was put in place because 2 times the max fare was simply too much and everybody agreed to that. That being said, the point of where would the revenue come from, and if we were to do something as modest as a 1.9 multiplier rather than the 2.0. My understanding is that's in the same revenue range as lowering the cap. So if we choose either one of those, we're kind of looking for about the same amount of money, was my understanding. But, and we would have to figure that out. I don't pretend that we don't. But I think that that, for speaking for Virginia and speaking for sustainability, that's really where we are at the moment.
Sir Dyke?
Yeah, I would obviously associate myself with what Mary said. The only thing I would add, and I mentioned this earlier when we were having a discussion at customer service, was that I see this being combined with a real aggressive effort for us to work with the region to address this issue of overall quality of life issue as it relates to our customers who are served by Metro Access, and that we need to tie this in. And this goes to the sustainability point Mary mentioned. This is something we're going to have to step up to as a region. And so I'm looking at it as sort of a two-pronged approach and would support the 1.9% and then pick up on what the GM said earlier, that we aggressively go to COG and others and make this the regional issue that it should be, and to recognize that we all have a stake in seeing that we have a quality service that is reliable and predictable and hopefully enhances the quality of life of our customers.
Thank you, Mr. Dyke. Mr. Downey.
Yeah. Just to make sure I'm clear here, if we went to the 1.9 multiplier, you're saying approximately a 3% average increase, but that still would be consist of a lot of people who pay nothing more and some people who will pay 5 or 6% more.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And then, again, I'm trying to see what makes overall fairness sense in this. And what does strike me is we treat the access user as if they were going to take the rail in many cases. That's what the multiplier, that's what the fare calculator does. But when it comes to pricing, we're treating them as if they're going to be charged with the bus fare increase. Their fare increase is much more like a bus rider, whereas rail riders are going to be paid less. Access riders are not getting that same level of ride quality.
I'm not sure that's right. Mark?
Let me just... Should we look at the... Is this the table to be looking at, I think?
That's the one I'm...
Yes. Again, I... My perception is that... You know,
I'm thinking of those who are going to get an increase, not the average of those
right.
who...
Oh, okay. Well, true.
Those will get no increase.
So the ones that ride rail have a price that's comparable, Metro Access price that's comparable to rail today.
Yeah.
And they have an increase.
Mm-hmm.
What percent increase will they see?
Well, okay. So if roughly half of the riders are paying twice bus, they will see the same increase that the bus riders will see.
Right.
Then there's that 25% who's in the middle who's going to see probably something like a 6% increase, and then there's the 25% at the top who will see nothing.
But again, if these riders were able to make a choice between bus and rail, they might well choose bus because it's less expensive. We're pricing them as if they must choose rail. I think the point of making bus stops more accessible is an important one because it would allow consumer choice.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Goldman.
The Metro Access issue is a very big one for Maryland. I think Christian can verify over 60% of the trips right now are being taken by persons with disabilities in Maryland. That's why it's very unfortunate that the way we approach this issue is as a fare and rate issue. I guess as we've been thinking about it over the past few weeks or so, it strikes us that this is really a broader issue that needs to be addressed, not just once every 2 years in the context of looking at fares and rates and Metro Access charges. That's why the kind of things we were talking about this morning that Mort mentioned, improving the bus stops to make them accessible, whereas I indicated Montgomery County has a $6 million investment in its capital investment plan to do, is an important part of the solution. going to COG and having them look at a regional solution is an important part of the broader solution. I guess that's why we'd like to see wherever we end up on this metro access fare issue, we include in our resolution next week some language which keeps the board and the staff focused on finding a long-term sustainable solution for the problem of metro access and the broader access of what do we do with an expanding community of people with disabilities who we would prefer to have ride the rails and ride the buses and try and find incentives and ways to move them off of having to rely on metro access because of the $56 a trip cost, which is astronomical when you think about it, and the part that it plays in our overall budget. So that's why, as we move forward, Mr. Chair, next week we would like to, on behalf of Maryland, provide some language to include in our resolution. I'll just read to you what we're thinking about, and maybe we can play with it over the next week. But the kind of resolution would say that the board, well, as part of the ongoing efforts in support of Momentum 2025, study long-term sustainability of metro access and related services, including demographic changes that will impact the number of eligible riders, improvements to bus and rail facilities to promote accessibility on fixed route transit, the effectiveness of metro access in comparison to human service, healthcare, and other providers in addressing riders' needs, alternative service delivery models for metro access riders, and the impact of metro access cost on riders and the funding jurisdiction, and produce a report with findings of these studies and a plan. We would set a date by December 31st, 2015, for meeting metro access riders' needs through 2025. So we would propose to include that kind of language as part of the resolutions in the broader fair resolution that this body takes up next week or the week after.
Thank you. We have a number of people who will speak. I promise Mr. Downs, then Mr. Downey, Mr. Dyke, then Ms. Hutchins.
I want to reemphasize Mr. Goldman's remarks. With a 6% increase forecast in excess ridership this year, we've exhausted the option of reducing our geographic coverage. We're down to FTA-mandated ADA coverage. We've exhausted our pricing as a demand reduction strategy, you've already said. There's no elasticity here. There's just no gains about, because this is not a choice service where you can make a choice about using the service or doing something else. I don't believe we know enough now about what's happening, about why we're getting a 6% increase. There are lots of suppositions. Mike mentioned demographics, changes in healthcare coverage. And while the facts won't set us free, they are sometimes helpful in making policy decisions for the board. I would suggest and encourage not only a plan, but resources being allocated to do the kinds of research that are necessary. We have a relatively small population of access riders. It ought to be relatively easy to do the survey work, interview work, that gets us a better understanding of the changes in the demographics of riders and to get a better handle on why we've got this kind of demand, because 6% increase in demand per year compounded is not sustainable longer than, say, three or four years maximum before this system collapses around us again. The stakes are incredibly high about finding the right solutions here, because we've exhausted all of the other solutions that we've had. I agree with Mr. Goldman that part of this has to be developing other jurisdiction member models that provide some of those services at the jurisdiction level. Arlington does it. Fairfax does it. It's the reason that your access charges are so low in Virginia. The district is starting to launch a access taxicab service for dialysis patients that would have a significant volume impact on access ridership. But I think we also have a role in providing maybe a forum for the jurisdictions about what has worked within the jurisdictions about other alternate services, the pros and cons, the cost, operating lessons. We did this kind of thing when we were trying to establish a uniform electronic fare system for all of the bus systems in the region about technical assistance and standards, et cetera. We could do the same thing about convening after the budget debates a regional roundtable about this set of issues and look at barriers to entry, ways of financing additional services. We don't have an answer. We're dealing with this kind of on a Band-Aid approach that we'll kind of have to look at in another 2 years. But I don't think this problem will wait for the next fare increase. 2 years is too long. If to have two more 6% increases in ridership. A proactive stance, I agree, we ought to have that kind of language in the resolution. It ought to be something that we could all support together about helping the region tackle this problem, because we can't just leave this as our problem. It's the region's problem as well. And it would be very unsatisfying to come to a number decision about access without a plan going forward besides just fixing this first round of stuff. So this has to be a package. It has to have a plan.
Mr. Danny.
Yes, if you could just refresh my memory. The treatment of Metro Access in the subsidy calculations is that it goes directly to the jurisdiction where the service is called from?
Yes, it's just on the number of trips for the residents of that jurisdiction.
So not to disagree with Mr. Downs, but this is in many ways a jurisdiction problem more than it is a regional problem, and that both the development of the amount of service and the development of alternatives that would encourage other services are very much up to the jurisdictions. Otherwise, you pay the bill.
Okay, Mr. Duncan, this is Hudson.
I'm glad to hear the discussion about the aggressive plan. And, I mean, we may talk about the language, but I totally agree that we need to have an aggressive approach here. But I just wanted to note for the record that back in 2005, the Council of Governments, the Board of Trade, and the Federal City Council came together with a task force that Tom Downs served on and I served on and Mort was staffed for. And two big recommendations. One was that the federal government needed to put money in for capital. And as a result of that was the PREA legislation, which obviously the jurisdictions went along with. But the other big component of that report was the fact that Metro Access was an issue that needed to be addressed because at that point it was really climbing in the budget, and that the region needed to step up and figure out how they were going to address that problem aggressively as a regional issue. And so I would suggest that we might want to dust that report off as a way. So this is not something we're just springing out of our heads today. There's a long time been a recognition that something needs to be done, but it's time for us to step up now and actually get it done.
Okay, thank you. Mrs. Hudgens.
Mr. Goldman, thank you for your language. I appreciate the urgency. I can relate to where you are, but just having had the discussion repeatedly, I can also have another a reflection on it. I think first and foremost, acknowledging the fact that it is a jurisdictional issue that, and it's a jurisdictional issue however you look at it, whether or not the jurisdictions provide the services or we come to Metro and pay for the services through the Metro Access Program. So I think the jurisdictions would welcome the opportunity to sit down with Metro as a convener and talk about this. But I, since I do a lot of human services, I ascribe to another aspect of this, and that is the aspect of the mandated role that Metro Access has and comes from the federal government. It doesn't come from the jurisdiction. And so that, to me, has to be part of that discussion. And what it may lend itself to is an opportunity to bring the providers to the table, not in a jurisdictional discussion, to understand who we serve and how we serve them and what role transportation plays in all of those folks. Because the impact on the jurisdictional costs to serving the disability community is a holistic one, not isolated only in transportation. And so as people arrive at a door, they arrive seeking service, and for some reason transportation is pulled out of the service delivery piece, and it's given as a transportation piece. So I think the discussion needs to be broader. When you started the one raising the task force of 2005, I thought sure you were going to go to that second part, as you did with Priya, to say, and yes, fund your human service side of the transportation model. And I would join you wholly. And I know that that is a hard discussion to have, since we bring the feds to the table, and they may say that they're already there. But really, we might want to look at the dollars and see what they mean and be able to raise that discussion. And it may not move, but I think it is it gives an opportunity to show the larger picture of what the service delivery means and how that funding comes to us here, and what is the impact by each jurisdiction having a choice of what they make on that.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions regarding Metro Access? Okay, I think I heard one proposal, which was a multiplier at 1.9 or keeping the way it is. I mean, those are kind of the choices out of the table today. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Attached to each, yes. Two. Right. I was going to ask for all of them.
I got 3%. I wasn't sure what the exact dollar costs were estimated.
Yes, absolutely. My suggestion is, let me kind of run through a list of what has been put on the table in terms of items that need further discussion. And then I think we'll talk a little bit about what we need next in terms of information. Now, we had on the table a question about the $2 bus surcharge, the 50 cents Prince George's County parking surcharge, the 25 cent daily parking increase, 25 cents, I'm sorry, and then the 1.9 multiplier. Okay. So we need to figure out the bill of all of them together. If you didn't do it, if you just accepted all these changes, what would the total annual cost be? Okay. Well, you don't have to do it today. I'm just saying. Okay. Sure.
Oh, thank you. So, again, keeping the $2 cash surcharge gains us approximately $1 million. Keeping the cash surcharge and raising it to $2 gains us about $1 million. Imposing the 50 cent surcharge in Prince George's County at their garages costs the WMATA operating budget approximately $1 million. That will put money into the surcharge account for Prince George's County, but it will cost the WMATA operating budget approximately $1 million. The 25 cent across the board daily parking increase, we had estimated at approximately $1.5 million. As we said, that's a little bit of a conservative estimate to try to account for 1.5. Yes, sir.
On the straight line, it's more
It's more like 2.5 on a straight line, yes, sir. And then the 1.9 multiplier, I have this, so I don't have to guess at what the number is. As compared to the general manager's proposal, about $500,000 change. So, again, I think, especially for the 1.9, we may need to go back and think a little. That's just our projected change for FY15. We may need to think a little bit more about what the potential longer term impacts of that are as well. No, but
thank you. Okay, with respect to the Prince George's County surcharge, I do feel we need to at least have Mr. Nichols here to have that as well, unless you want to.
If I may respond, I've been in telepathic conversation.
Have you?
My
that was a buzzing I heard.
Prince George's County, watching too many new television shows. So I wanted to just relate some of the rationale, okay. Policy rationale for it, as well as what the short-term cost of change is. Essentially, of the 86 Metrorail stations, 15 are in Prince George's County, and they have the most promise for future development, those 15, especially with the Silver Line, because the 15th and their corridors have underutilized capacity, which constrains cost recovery for the rail system. Essentially, we're going to be providing a lot of capacity there and want to increase the number of riderships. So the funds will be used, and the local surcharge will be back invested in improvements that will enable growth and development of these stations. So that will produce more transit-oriented developments, more riders. And so in the long term, it should be a net long-term plus for the system. In the short term, basically, as Mr. Schofield explained, there's basically a $1 million dollar loss to Metro. On the other hand, the bus cash surcharge produced a $1 million increase. So from the general manager's prior proposal to this one, it's basically a wash in terms of revenue. The revenue from the cash surcharge balanced by the loss from including the additional 25 cents for the Prince George's County parking fee. That's the telepathic information I've been provided.
Amazing.
So I guess the question I have, because I was not aware until this came up, that jurisdictions had the potential for a separate surcharge, and I thought we were doing this under the 50-cent agreement that, you know, we had all sort of, the board had approved, but that this would be used for economic development for all intents and purposes. This is to build a fund that will help PG leverage an economic development at this location. And I guess the question I have is that the point of the surcharges on parking garages? Because, again, I just didn't understand that we did that it came back. We have no parking, you know, we have no parking garages in Arlington, so I wouldn't necessarily know this.
We have a couple of, several parking agreements. There's several, we're actually renegotiating one in Virginia right now with the new parking structures that Virginia built because of the Silver Line. And so the intent of the surcharge, if I remember these agreements, they're somewhat dated, but was to use them for actually debt service to build a garage, right? So the surcharge was allocated for that purpose. In terms of financing associated with the debt associated with building a garage, there was some other, some other areas that they could use a surcharge with maybe some maintenance associated with it and things like that.
So it's all around the asset itself.
That's the basis of the older agreements. We're in negotiations with Virginia now trying to revise the agreements with respect to surcharge, and that's, you know, in the process of being discussed.
I guess my concern, and it's a concern going forward and it's a policy concern, is as we struggle to balance these budgets, if we, you know, how much leverage do individual jurisdictions have to put some money on their side of the ledger, causing the rest of us to have to step in and fill a gap in a proportion. And it's a big conversation, I think. So I respect what Prince George's is trying to do. I understand they want that development. The region wants that development. But in the context of balancing this budget, I'm just not entirely sure how comfortable I am. And perhaps, you know, we need a little bit more staff helping us think through the pros and cons of this moving forward so that we know what's available to us as a jurisdiction that doesn't have any parking garages. Potentially, I'm always on the donor side, and that's a concern to me.
And at the risk of maybe making Mr. Goldman angry, I don't want to do that. I just want to separate the discussion because the cash surcharge, even though there's an offset, the cash surcharge is offsetting the 50-cent parking, they're not related. I don't want to make that statement. This was really just a discussion among the JCC to figure out, as a group, how to maybe potentially balance a budget on a regional basis. So it's a good point that you're making, but it's not. It shouldn't be a related. They're not related.
But it changes the amount of money.
But it does change the amount of money
to put in.
I agree with that.
And so it is related.
It may not be related.
I was just paraphrasing your own slide, so you gave it to me, so I used it.
I think Mr. Starles had a help.
No.
Sure.
I think that's fair. I think it would be perhaps helpful on this parking issue for you to. If your stance is we need to take this apart and think about this parking surcharge from a policy point of view, then help us do that. But recognize that some jurisdictions have access to significant funds associated with this, and other jurisdictions do not. So help us think about that together so that we end up in a place where there's some possibility of equity and access to that same kind of dollar possibility for development. If that's really where we're going, then it seems to me we have to have that conversation, not just back into it. At the same time, we can't take apart the fact that these two things have collided and that my subsidy is potentially impacted by the fact that parking fares don't have a lot of, seem to not be terribly elastic in this place, and there's, you go up that much, there's going to be a decrement to ongoing revenue. So I don't know, maybe Prince George's splits it with us to cover the hole, and they get the million, but the million comes back to the system. I don't know. But I think we have to have that conversation rather than just saying, you know, the rest of us cover the gap.
We have a memo coming to the board that you should get tomorrow that will explain the history and the context of the parking surcharge program and sort of where we are currently, and then it puts the Prince George's request into that sort of broader context, and then we can certainly be available once you've looked at that to answer any more questions.
Mrs. Hutchins.
I just want to make Mr. Hines feel better and recognize that I don't think you should be thought of as a donor, because I think you recognize that this system is a regional system, and as we go from one end to the other, when I end up in Arlington, I think there's a benefit that comes back to you. and I think it's, I think the whole discussion that we're having is trying to balance the needs throughout the region where we all have some differences, and because we have some differences, we come to the table with some different kinds of needs with the pretty much the same goal. So I understand what you say, and recognizing the sexiest thing to build is not a garage, not by me anyway. And so I'd even take Mr. Goldman's view and say I'd do my economic development with my money a lot faster. And so it's I think what we all have to keep in mind as we work through this budget is that all of us are at a different place as we progress through this, where we are in our growth and development. And so we come with different needs. I do want to go to the point that you responded on the parking result that was that it could be as high as 2.5 million. But isn't that the result of not taking into the ridership reflection because the deficit that would occur? And I think, yeah, I think it, we don't want to get too far on that one.
Just going to the parking question, I mean, since we're seeking more information to help us make a decision, I mean, what further information would be helpful to better understand the impacts of the 25-cent surcharge, I mean, price increase on parking? So I know we had this range that was talked about. I mean, is there anything else that we could ask of staff that would help you make a better a decision on this one way or another? I mean,
Is it at all helpful to look at what the increase is of bus, rail, plus parking? We have bus and rail, but not bus, rail, plus parking. In terms of percentage increase.
Yeah.
In terms of
it would be good to reflect each of the modes and as their increase and then the combination increase. Combination of the modes and the increase. I don't think we have a combination of parking anymore.
We have bus and rail, but
you have,
not
yeah,
bus,
have
and rail,
bus and rail.
Parking. There you go.
Yeah.
And then I think
you could do both. You could do both. You could do rail plus parking. You could do bus rail parking.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that's also
that's
really
a good
helpful.
Idea. Thank you.
Because if we're going to do better test scores, and I could probably construct one, but you all need to have, as Mary said, you all can help us with a story. If it's an increase in bus of 10% and rail of 3 or 3.5%, and access at 5 and no parking, what's
why? What's the rationale? Okay. Mr. Goldman.
Could we also ask staff to identify paygoes where we might be able to pay for what's potentially $2 to $3 million loss in revenue?
Out of the expense side? Out of our
I'm leaving it from the staff to.
You have on the revenue side.
A 0.5% on the rail fare would be an additional $3 million.
Well, if you did all these things.
yes, but
I think it would be helpful to have some. I don't think we want to put all the burden on the rider, whether it be bus or transit. So I think it would be useful and helpful for staff to come forward with some cost cuts. Changes quality or changes.
Right. We had identified a number of initiatives in the FY15 proposal. A number of those that we think are actually pretty essential to improving our existing service. We would rather not offer those up. The ones I think that are most natural would be the reducing the contribution to the OPEB, lowering from $5 million down to whatever the amount would be needed. Reductions in the investment that we would make in the bus PCN and state of good repair, and some of our customer service outreach. we can give you the specific numbers associated with each of those.
And also the consequences of not funding it. I think that's very important.
Yes.
To state in your...
Right.
Your
the, another one I'd ask you just to look at is I know we've gone from $15 million to $10 million in reserve, but if we were to be able to get this down to $500,000 or $1 million of a gap, what is the consequence of that reserve being $9 million instead of $10 million? I'd ask you to, for, is that this year's?
Yeah.
We're saying that we had recommended reserving $10 million for contingencies in 14, and she's asking what?
Well, that was what I was asking, is tell us the consequences.
Snow days.
I hope the dentist knows.
So,
don't
so do I.
Yeah. Federal government closure. This is Hudgens.
I have a question. We used to provide human service agencies smart trip cards. Do we still do that? Free.
We do. I don't know.
Can you
if we've done it in a while, but if they call, we replenish them. You know, at no cost.
And we used to get a report as to how many they had. Requested and or used to.
I think we almost gave about 60,000 out, Kathy, if I remember.
It would be good to know.
But we can give you an update. Yeah.
Okay.
Going back to the bus surcharge, cash surcharge. Is there any other pieces of information that would be helpful to the board? I know she maybe Mr. Downs can channel. Okay. Well, I mean, Mr. Nolan was so affected. Okay, maybe we could ask.
Sure. Revenue on the bus surcharge.
Okay.
It's.
Being it would add approximately $1 million.
Okay.
Okay. I know her staff person is here. So would you ask.
Judah, could you channel it?
Can you channel? Yeah. But if you could ask Mrs. Bowser, Councilwoman Bowser, if she had any other questions or data that would help or information that would help her better understand the implications of the $2 surcharge. Okay, that would be helpful. And then coming back to the paratransit, Metro Access issue and the multiplier or any other option that you might want to consider. Is there any other pieces of information that would be helpful for that? No? Okay. Okay, so you have a list of things that we need to follow up on. Again, we have to make a decision whether we're going to package this up so at the end of the day it pays for itself through revenues. They will also show us the consequences of taking off the expense side, but I do think we hope to focus on the revenue side first as part of that. I will ask the Secretary of the Board to schedule a meeting to follow up on this. Yes, yes, Mr. Dyke. Yeah, I know. There are a lot of people missing.
Unfortunately, half the board's gone.
Some of
the voting
members
are here.
Yeah, I know. Well, we could maybe.
It's really out.
Sure. Okay.
Well, tomorrow, why don't we send a survey to the board members about the availability to make sure that we can get a quorum?
Yeah.
And then the obvious threshold is we have to get a quorum.
Yes. Well, maybe ask the other question. I mean, are there any days that don't work for people?
Day,
so if you have a day that
but you have, they're all hard.
I know.
It's budget season.
I know.
So
it's budget season.
Then I have to get moved around in order to do this, and some days things are more movable than others.
And some we may have to have part of this be a phone-in.
Okay.
Because we can have committee meetings and board meetings where members.
Call. Yes.
Call in.
Okay.
So I wasn't kidding when I said no day between now and now.
They're horrible. Yeah. It's a horrible season.
I know. Oops.
Sorry.
Does
anyone have any
objections?
What evenings. What evenings.
I'm fine.
I'm fine with that.
Okay, so we'll work with John and Lloyd.
You'll find that a lot of elected board members have more evening aggressive meetings. Evening yes. schedules than day schedules.
That is true. It's all for I know, I know. But we have to.
Well, I usually object yes. to even
all
the
right. So with that, any other, are there any other questions or issues that we need to address with respect to the budget before we convene?
I've got a comment that I think is worth sure. hearing.
And I normally object strongly to taking up something in committee and on the board at the same day, but given the fact we've had lengthy discussion today and maybe sharing of information between now and then, I would not raise that objection.
Okay.
If that works.
Okay. So we may have this meeting on the 27th. Okay.
But we'll still do the survey about availability yes. to right. see if we can get a quorum. And if okay. we can, we'll give it a try. And if not, we'll have it before the board meeting.
Okay. So thank you, everyone, for your patience. And we'll see you on the 27th. This meeting
Doctors
is adjourned.
Patience.